This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I know, it's a little scary, right? Especially the way things started today. Still, I think I'm going to say it one more time, everybody. Just take a deep breath, would you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 24th of August, and mark your calendars, everybody, because we are all going to remember this one for a while. Because, come on, the Dow off almost 1,100 points at the open. In case you somehow weren't glued to the TV today, here is a very quick refresher of how things went.
Fear took hold this morning.
The Dow down almost 1,100 points.
There was real, genuine panic selling like I haven't seen in years.
Every stock at one point in the NASDAQ 100 started in the red.
Volatility, it's an understatement.
It only takes one person to shout fire, and everybody else starts to look for the smoke.
An epic plunge.
No buyers.
Major volatility.
You get the idea, right? Panic, pandemonium. But let's take a step back here and break it down. Okay? Let's start at the very beginning of the day's happenings, China, Shanghai specifically, and the 8.5% drop on the Shanghai Composite Index, a drop that came without the expected intervention by the Chinese government, because that is what they've been doing all summer, intervening. So we did what we do when stuff happens over there. We get our Shanghai correspondent, Rob Schmitz, on the line. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
All right. Well, this has been quite a summer over there. And I guess the thing that stands out to me today is that Beijing decided to leave it alone today when all this started happening.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part today, they did leave it alone. And look what happened. Biggest one-day drop in 8 years on the Shanghai Composite, prompting markets everywhere else to spiral out of control.
There had been some talk that they were going to do something over the weekend, and everybody was kind of waiting for it. It didn't happen. What can we read into that? Have they given up? Is it a new strategy? What's the deal?
Well, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that this whole we're going to open our markets thing wasn't that well thought out from the beginning. China's economic gurus should have foreseen the margin lending, the short selling, the market shenanigans that happen everywhere else, and they should have been prepared for it. But, you know, when things started going badly at the beginning of the summer, the state immediately intervened and they kept doing it. And each time they stepped in, investors became less confident that China's leaders knew what they were doing. And we all know what happens to an economy when everyone begins to lose confidence in it at the same time. You know, I spoke to Ann Stevenson Yang about this today. She's an analyst at J Capital, and here's how she framed it.
The problem is that by intervening, they've made the whole market about what the government does rather than about any of the fundamentals. And so now if they would have to use massive amounts of money to bring it back, and yet if they don't do anything, the market continues to fall. I have no idea what they should do.
All right, well, that's not reassuring that a woman who covers China has no idea what to do. Do you think the government has an idea what to do?
The Chinese government has tried to flood its banking system with cash by freeing up more funds for lending. It's done this several times, and it's rumored that the central bank might do that again. Will it work? Did it work the other handful of times it attempted this? You know, we wouldn't be talking about this if it did. I think the essence of the problem here is that China's government says it wants to reform its financial system. It says it wants a more open market, but it really doesn't want to commit to doing the very painful things that it needs to do in order to make this happen. It doesn't want to take away power from the state-owned enterprise sector because it'll mean that the party loses power. It feels it needs to step in anytime anything bad happens. So these economic reforms are really only going part of the way. If China wants a healthier financial system, it has to fully commit to it and has to relinquish some control. And so far, at least, it doesn't appear that Beijing wants to do that.
Hey, how did you get home from work tonight? Did you take your scooter? Did you ride your bike? What'd you do?
I took a cab.
Did you? All right. So what did the cabbie have to say about all this?
he just shook his head. You know, he said the one thing that, you know, I think is the catch-all phrase when something really bad happens and you have no control over it, which is mei banfa, which means basically there's no other way. I can't control this. And that's the problem. They can't control it. The government's controlling the whole thing. And, you know, that's been sort of the story up until now. That's been the script.
Yeah.
You know, the government needs to let it go. And people need a banfa. They need a way.
Yep. Mei banfa. Nothing you can do. Rob Schmitz in Shanghai for us. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
There is a really big, what does this mean for us part of this story? Because, I mean, come on, China is the second biggest economy in the world, and a day in the markets like today is no small thing, deep breath or not. So we went out and we asked some people how they were feeling about things.
It hasn't affected me yet, so I'm okay. Yeah.
I still think it's going to be a good investment to invest in the economy, and that's the stock market. So we're not too concerned.
No worries about these things. I think they'll all work itself out.
Well, it's a little scary, but I'm leaving my money where it is.
I was concerned that this may be a signal that something else is about to collapse or change real drastically.
That was Paul Weller from Washington, D.C., Ash Grayson and Margot Steckinger right here in Los Angeles, and Donald Nixon out of North Birmingham, Alabama. But back to my point, I digressed a bit, I suppose. What does this mean for us? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that.
There's an expression in Chinese that goes something like this.
山雨欲来风满楼.
It means coming events cast their shadows before them. And that's what markets in the U.S. and the world are worried about, that a few bad indicators in China signify a really sharp slowdown. But here's the thing about markets.
They can go off on a path on their own that's not very much connected with reality.
Nicholas Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The U.S. has relatively little vulnerability to a slowdown in China if it were to occur.
The bottom line is we don't sell much to China, maybe 1-2% of our output, and a Chinese slowdown would only shave a little bit off of that. Now, if you happen to be among those exporters making things like planes or power plants for China, then sure, a slowdown won't be good for you. And
there are a lot of important companies, Caterpillar, General Electric, United Technologies, that produce goods in China that they mostly sell in China.
Those sales have gone down. There are some not-so-direct ways we might be affected, too. David Dollar is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's China Center.
If the Chinese slowdown, you know, really hurts other economies that are connected to the U.S., then, of course, we feel this indirectly.
But really, the effects can be all over the place, some good and some bad. Clara Gillespie is with the Bureau of Asian Research.
You know, it really depends on if you see China as a consumer, if you see them as a source of goods, if you see them as a partner or as a potential competitor.
Even the scary market fluctuations are not as scary as they seem. Justin Wolfers teaches economics at the University of Michigan.
U.S. financial markets are down a few percent, as are other major countries. But take a step back from this past week and look at the last 7 years. The U.S. stock market has more than doubled.
So yes, the U.S. is a little bit vulnerable to a Chinese slowdown, but we're also vulnerable to a lot of other things, like the weather or the Federal Reserve. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
As bad as today was in stocks, and let there be no sugarcoating here, it was in the short term bad. But equities got nothing on commodities. You name it, cotton, oil, sugar, nickel, wheat. One leading index of global commodities is down more than 30% for the past year. So what's that saying? After every boom, there is a bust. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
This bust goes back a ways to a commodity boom that started around 2000. You know the story. China went modern. It bought soybeans to feed pigs, to feed people. and iron ore for steel and coal for power. Futures broker Pratik Patel is the founder of Trade Futures for Less.
Definitely a super cycle. I mean, you saw the prices rally and they stayed higher for a very long time.
Even when prices dipped briefly,
buyers would step in and markets would rally back up.
There's a history of super cycles, and economist Bilge Ertan at Northeastern studies them. She found long commodity booms tend to be built on colossal demand from the U.S. after the Civil War, from Europe and Japan after World War II. And then they ended, Ertan says, just as China's industrial peak has come and gone too.
In the future, it won't be China that's going to be demanding more and more commodities. So there doesn't seem to be another country that's going to be new powerhouse that's going to demand all these commodities.
She figures prices may stay low a while. Producers of copper and silver and coffee have overinvested and oversupplied. As for oil, too many drillers are still hanging on, so the glut continues.
Now we are in the downturn for only about 3 years. It could last another 5 to 10 years, potentially, in terms of the historical trend.
If that's the case, the big resource countries that partied the last decade, Australia, Brazil, the oil states, will have to find something else to sell in the next. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Left unsaid thus far in the program is what all of this means for Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve, and interest rates. You want to know why we left it unsaid? Because anybody who says they know what Janet Yellen is thinking is making it up. Friday on the program, I asked Lee Gallagher and Cardiff Garcia a version of our five words question that we usually put to CEOs. I asked Cardiff and Lee what Janet Yellen is thinking right about now in five words or less. So here's what I want you to do. You give it a shot. Five words or less. What is Janet Yellen thinking? Let us know on our Facebook page. We are Marketplace APM there. Or on Twitter, we are at Marketplace there. Coming up,
your reputation would immediately be ruined and you couldn't work anywhere.
Stealing jokes is nothing to laugh about, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. This is not the kind of deja vu we want all over again, no matter how much I love the wah-wah trombones. After a wild, wild ride today, the Dow Industrials closed down 588 points, about 3.5%, 15,871. Yes, I did say 15,000. The NASDAQ peeled off 179 points, 3.8%, closed at 4526. The S&P 500 erased 77 points, 3.9%, 1893 there. China notwithstanding, financials were already in a foul mood over last week's Fed minutes. Citigroup withdrew 6%. Morgan Stanley said so long to 5.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase lost more than 5% today. Oil continued down its slippery slope. Crude below $39 a barrel. That is a 6.5-year low. Oil stocks followed. Chevron spilled 4.8%. ExxonMobil poured off more than 4.5% today. And then there was tech. All the big names were down. Netflix took a hit of almost 7%. Facebook gave away more than 4.5% today. All that money went somewhere. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to 2.01%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Just about a year or a year and a half ago, there was a 911 emergency system outage that affected 11 million people in seven states. 6,600 911 calls went unanswered. Nobody died, but the idea that you would dial 911 and nobody would answer the phone is somewhat unsettling. The cause of the outage wasn't a big storm, wasn't a natural disaster. It was a software glitch. And similar outages are happening more and more often as the 911 system is shifted from analog to digital, a transition that has been rocky at best. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on that.
Hi, 17, thank you.
Hi, it's Joe Keith, Evanston with a transfer. Go ahead, miss.
When a call comes in to the 911 center in Evanston, a suburb north of Chicago, Carl Hastings doesn't ask what the emergency is.
Evanston 911, where is your emergency?
He asks where it is. That's because a lot of calls come from wireless phones and internet-based phones. Unlike landlines, they don't always send along reliable addresses to 911. That leaves Hastings with two options. Either get the location from the caller, which happens most of the time, or...
We would send officers to the vicinity to see if they can locate anything.
So they'll just start looking around?
Correct.
Eventually, a fully internet-based system will eliminate this guesswork and even bring in videos and photos from callers.
We are in this uneasy transition phase between old and new technology.
Henning Scholzreny was chief technology officer at the FCC until he left a year ago for Columbia. Now he teaches computer science and engineering. Scholzreny and other telecom experts say the transition isn't happening fast enough. One reason is that it's expensive, and the bulk of the cost is covered by small 911 fees on your phone bill. In the meantime, the system has become a patchwork of workarounds, not fully internet-based, not completely analog.
It makes the system more complicated, in some sense more brittle, and it leads to less redundancy.
In other words, fewer backup systems. To keep costs down, telecom companies have outsourced their 911 routing to subcontractors, which consolidate customers from multiple states. That's created the potential that a single point of failure can knock out service for millions.
We've seen a number of sunny day outages in the last year or so.
David Firth is deputy bureau chief of the FCC's Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau.
Outages that instead of affecting maybe a single community, they were affecting an entire state or an entire region.
That's what happened in April of 2014. A software glitch in one operations center in Colorado knocked out 911 service in parts of California, Florida, Washington, and four other states. The FCC fined two subcontractors involved in the outage more than $17 million. The agency is now looking to implement new national guidelines, proposing, among other things, that companies be required to conduct regular audits to ensure that they have working backup systems.
We take 911 very seriously, so there is a sense of importance in terms of making the changes that need to be made.
Some in the telecom industry have objected, saying the FCC is overreaching into areas of 911 oversight that are the purview of states. AT&T filed comments with the FCC, arguing that the new rules would be costly and burdensome, and that the FCC can't regulate the 911 ecosystem into a, quote, zero-defect and outage-free world. The FCC's comment period is ended for the proposed new rules, but the agency won't say when they may be introduced. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Wow. Lost in the hullabaloo that was the capital markets today was some corporate news. Chipotle is going on a hiring spree. It's going to hire 4,000 people all in one day next month. The burrito maker is pushing the jobs as potential starts to a career, not just short-term gigs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on why Chipotle and some other fast food chains as well have to make a pretty hard sell to get workers on board nowadays.
There's a lot of competition for restaurant workers right now. Chipotle spokesperson Chris Arnold.
Heading into the fall is typically a time when we see something of a slowdown in the number of applications we receive, and yet our hiring needs really remain.
That's because many younger workers are quitting their summer jobs and heading back to school. Chipotle's pitch to hourly workers is that they could become managers, maybe netting a six-figure salary and a company car. Hudson Reilly is with the National Restaurant Association.
There's a saying in the industry that you can go from the dish room to the boardroom, and that's certainly true.
The association says about 9 out of 10 managers in the restaurant industry started as hourly workers, but it's rare for people to get the kind of money Chipotle is talking about. Robert Kurzak recruits for restaurants, including Chipotle.
You know, right now it is a candidate-driven market. Candidates right now can choose from an abundance of different opportunities right now, a different amount of offers.
Chipotle may have to work harder than its competitors. The company's been embroiled in a number of class action lawsuits. Some promoted managers say they were pushed to work longer hours without compensation. But the National Restaurant Association points out wages are rising faster in the restaurant industry compared to other sectors of the economy, making a career in fast food not a bad choice. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Funny business is big business. I'm talking jokes here, and I'm talking really big business, too, because think about it for just a second. For every punchline delivered by Jimmy, either one of them, or Seth or Conan, there are hundreds that don't make it out of the writer's room. Stand-up comedians test thousands of jokes on the way to a successful routine. So cashing in on somebody's jokes without attribution is not so funny. And there is something of an uproar in the entertainment world right now over joke stealing, and it has put some comedians in a very bad humor. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is here to talk about that. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so what do you got?
Well, so the current outcry came after news that this internet star, who is known as the Fat Jewish, a.k.a. Josh Ostrowski, got picked up by a talent agency here in Los Angeles called CAA. It's one of the biggest talent agencies around. And this guy's basically built a career around aggregating slash stealing, depending on how you want to call it, other people's content, often without attribution. And so there's been discussion among comedians about this guy and this trend online for a long time, but all of a sudden the news that he got picked up by CAA sort of made everybody's head explode a little bit.
They are angry, I imagine. Are they, you know, like lawsuit angry?
Well, so that's a really interesting question, is whether or not jokes are copyrightable, fall under intellectual property law. And so to answer it, I got in touch with a professor named Christopher Sprigman. And I found him because he co-wrote this 80-page paper on jokes and intellectual property.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating. I love when people do that.
I know. So he teaches copyright law at New York University, and he told me that copyright law covers the expression of the idea, but not the nugget, not the idea itself.
All right.
A comedian who's interested in lifting a joke could possibly just lift the underlying comedic idea and express it somewhat differently and escape the reach of the copyright law altogether.
So here's the thing. Even if there is a copyrightable claim, these lawsuits cost a ton of money. But here's the really interesting part.
Okay, what?
There's an informal code among comedians that means they don't even need this law.
Really?
They don't need this at all. Yeah.
Is it Sprigman, like Omerta or something? I mean, right?
Sprigman found this in his research that basically comedians don't let each other steal jokes.
Wow.
And I talked to a comedian named Brian Gare who works in Austin, and he told me how it works with stand-ups.
Okay.
If you hacked someone's joke and used it, you would be instantly ostracized. Comics do a good job of policing themselves in that fashion. Your reputation would immediately be ruined, and you couldn't work anywhere. People would put the word out, and it's almost the equivalent of a blacklist.
Wow.
You're done if you copy somebody's stand-up routine. But online, it's a different world.
So hold on, online, right? Twitter, Snapchat, all that stuff. Talk to me about social media here, because, you know, you say something funny online and bang, everybody owns it.
Yeah, and well, everybody, really. They don't just retweet it, but they take it and tweet it as their own account. Right. This happens on Instagram, too, all the time. Brian says he has jokes ripped off all the time. Anytime there's something funny, people are tweeting it out. And he says some of the people tweeting his work, actually claiming it as his own, are getting followers and making money off it. And that's what makes him crazy. Advertisers, he says, they don't care about this informal comedy code. They care about the number of followers next to your name.
Right, right.
Advertisers and the public at large almost don't care. They're like, well, he's really popular, or this account's really popular. I want to work with him.
Really recently, we've seen Twitter start taking down some plagiarized posts based on copyright claims of the person who says they tweeted that original tweet.
So what happens now? Do we rely on like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram to police and somebody's going to file a lawsuit? I mean, what happens?
So I asked a woman named Mara Quintat. She's a comedy writer and has been one of the people really outspoken against this online joke stealing. She thinks the change is most likely going to come from public opinion, getting to a point where advertisers don't want to be affiliated with somebody cashing in on someone else's work.
If we take away the financial incentive, this becomes a much smaller problem, and it's something that, of course, will still happen, but it's going to happen on a much, much smaller scale.
So we're going to have to see just how much you and I decide we really care about who wrote what joke.
Give proper credit, people. It's easy. Marketplace's Adrian Hill covers entertainment for us. Thank you, Adrian.
Thanks, Guy.
This final note on the way out today, in which Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, tries to make us all feel better about the stock market. In an email to employees this morning, when, remember, in case somehow you'd forgotten, the Dow opened off 1,100 points, Schultz said in this email, quote, "Our customers are likely to experience an increased level of anxiety and concern. Please recognize this, and as you always have, remember that our success is not an entitlement, but something we need to earn every day." Continuing, he said, "Let's be very sensitive to the pressures our customers may be feeling." End of quote. Those are customers, quite possibly, like some of these folks.
Obviously, it's worrisome, but I am hopeful it will bounce back.
I think that there's some skepticism comes in and out, but overall, I think the whole economy in the country is on a big comeback.
I wouldn't take any chance on any high stake risk or anything now. So I manage my money carefully, and I just wait for things to get better.
Close your eyes, don't look, and stay strong.
Stay strong. That was Kirk Victor in Washington, D.C., Bonnie Lawler in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Maurice Rice from Birmingham, Alabama, and Jonte Turner, Upper Marlboro, Maryland, on a day that the Dow fell 588 points. Take a second. Tell us how you're feeling about your economy and about the events of the past, I don't know, 72, 96 hours on Wall Street. You can get us on Facebook. Marketplace APM is where we are. All right, we're out of here. As promised, Monday was interesting. The Dow closed down 588 points, 3.5%. Let me just, by the way, put that in perspective. 3.6% decline does not make it into the top 10 of Dow declines ever. So there's that. The NASDAQ off 3.8%. The S&P 500, 3.9% to the downside. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.